Okay, so moving right along here. This, by the way, this lecture, I swear, was put together before the whole Sydney Sweeney thing. So the genes, G versus J, was not intended to be a reference here, but it is what it is. So the announcements here, we've just went through the first unit. Thanks for all the great conversation on the reading exercise and perusal. There's now another reading exercise. So I hope that what you took out of that last reading exercise about the fish was that there, if you just studied an individual fish in isolation and you alter the kind of chemical environment around them, you may not see a effect on their fitness, and you might conclude that that chemical change around them and in those hormones that they're uptaking actually has no effect on the population. But when you actually then put fish together and allow them to interact, then what you find is it does affect their fitness when in the context of other animals. So that sort of shows that in order to really understand the physiology, you also have to incorporate the behavior. So the two of them are sort of intermixed. You have to be very careful if you make inferences about one without considering the other. So moving on, Unit B, we've got another article that I'm hoping you'll read kind of with the thought, with the perspectives we'll talk about in these first couple of lectures in mind. And that is available on Perusal for you to take a look at, as well as this comprehension assignment. So just as a reminder, the reading assignments, I really think that those are ones that I view as important, as I think they really do add something. So that's why I've got the lower drop policy. But the comprehension assignments are just meant to be tools to sort of make sure you're catching everything as we're going along. And they've got a much more generous drop policy, just as a reminder. So any questions about admin stuff? Okay, great. So catching up, this is kind of, last lecture, we talked about how there's ethology and behaviorism, how ethology was this term that kind of came out of biology, where those were sort of focusing on the largely innate behaviors, behavioral responses to the environment, as opposed to behaviorism, which came out of psychology, which was largely focused on how the animal might change in response to its experiences. And so one was sort of focused on the outside coming in, the other one was focused on the inside going out. And I mentioned behavioral ecology sort of tries to add more layers to this and connect it across many different time scales, not just the time scale of right now, but the developmental time scale, the evolutionary time scale, and functional purpose, sort of adaptation. So that's, behavioral ecology. But still, even at this level, this early level, there's this fundamental tension that's showing up between nature and nurture. And so the classical question has been nature versus nurture. Which one is more important? Is it the environment or is it the developmental trajectory? Is it the experience of the animal? Which one is more important in figuring out these things? G versus E, genotype versus the environment. Which one is a bigger determiner of phenotype? Going back to the Sydney Sweeney thing, is it big G genes or little G genes? And so if you're saying it's big G genes, then what you're saying is that it doesn't matter what the model wears, the model's always going to look great. If it's if it's little J genes, the environment, then you're saying that the way the model looks really is a function of what they put on and not the model itself. So it's a little weird. Like that whole advertising campaign, because it's effectively saying, it's confusing this idea to say that, well, here's a person that we're claiming would look good in anything, come buy our genes, which it's like it doesn't quite make sense because they're asserting the importance of G and trying to sell you E, and that there's some cognitive dissonance there, at least for me. And that's what we're going to sort of be talking about today is this idea. Is it G? Is it E? To what extent is it one versus the other? So G here, when I talk about G, genotype, we have to remind ourselves what a gene is. So a gene, we're saying, this is all review, discrete unit of inheritance located at a point on a so-called chromosome. So a chromosome is a collection of these genes. Each gene variant is that location is an allele of that gene. It's a Greek for other. So the existence of alleles suggests the existence of other forms at that gene. So that's where allele comes from. So there is a, we use the shorthand. There is a gene for. So a gene for X and a gene for Y, and you could either have X or Y, then that or that other, that's where the term allele comes from. So an allele is a variant of a gene. And so each allele is a specific sequence of nucleotides. And one of the kind of cool things about the architecture of our genes is that those alleles, although they sort of are roughly the same position on the chromosome, they don't have to fit in to the same size spot. So that's why we've got these start codons and stop codons that you've all talked about in your genetics course in 340 or whatever. And so, in that case, it's actually possible to have significant, major changes in alleles at the same gene. So it's not like you just have to swap out the same number of letters for, a similar number of letters. It could be, quite different as long because they're bracketed by these start and stop codons. And so you can slide that in and your genetic architecture, it knows how to look around the right locations for those alleles, and it knows to then start at the start codon and go until that stop codon, even if it's, a little bit or a very long length. And so that, they don't have to be exactly the same size. So you can get a lot of variation at a particular locus, at a particular gene location. If you take all of those alleles in an individual, then you get a genotype. So the genotype is not a collection of genes, it's a collection of alleles. So I have a genotype, you have a genotype, and so on. So I have a certain selection of alleles, you have a certain selection of alleles, and so on. That's our genotype. Then to get down to the phenotype here, the gene-like thing that we have here is a character. So a character is a dimension on which two individuals can observably vary in a sort of fitnessy sense. So it's a way, it's something that theoretically speaking, selection can act on. So, can functionally differ. So eye color, just talking abstractly, the notion of eye color, not a particular color, that is a character. And so if there's a particular if a bird has a particular color and that color could be selected for in sexual interactions, or could be sexual selection for a particular color, that color is the phenotype, but the particular color blue, we're going to say is the trait. So the state that the character can take, a character state, that is a trait. So you have a certain trait, you have brown eyes, you have blue eyes, that's your trait. If we recognize that eyes vary in these ways, then eye color, that is the character. The collection of traits is the phenotype. So it's not a collection of characters, it's a collection of traits. So I have a genotype, I have a phenotype, those are mine, they're unique to me. You have a genotype, you have a phenotype, they're yours, they're unique to you. They do not necessarily map onto each other. That's kind of a big point that we're going to be talking about in this unit. Let me mute that. Let me try that again. So that's coming. One more time. It's this mysterious extra speaker. Let me try that. Okay. All right. I think I'm still recording audio, but not playing audio. Sorry about that. It was a little weird, ghostly. Let me get rid of that message up there too. This room has just not been good to me. Okay. All right. So, any questions? Genotype versus phenotype. I know review, hear this all the time. Okay. So, the connection between them, nature versus nurture, that's where the debate is. So, is G more important? Is P more important? Now, classically, it's been the versus. Is it more G? Is it more P? The more modern perspective is via, though, is that you don't really get phenotype from just genotype or just environment. It's the combination of the two. So, the modern way we talk about this, the lingo that we use is G by E, or specifically G by E to P. So, people will say, oh, it's a G by E. What they mean by that is there's an interaction effect where if you know someone's genes, that's not enough. If you know the environment, that's not enough. It's the combination of the genes in that environment. That's what gives rise to the phenotype. The bird, for example, it might only be able to have a blue color if it can find a particular blue pigment in its environment. So then it has to have the gene variant, the allele that allows it to express blue if it can find blue in the environment. So if it has that variant, and it happens to find that blue in the environment, then it will express blue. Otherwise, even if it has the gene, it won't express blue. So you might have an allele for brown eyes, but how are the brown eyes expressed? If that brown eye requires something from the environment and it's not there, it doesn't matter that you have the allele for brown eyes, you'll express some other color. So it's not enough just to have the G, it's not enough just to have the E. In many cases, it's G by E. So we'll use that term periodically, G by E. Just we'll kind of throw it out there. So we refer to this process of going from G by E to P as gene expression or phenotypic expression. Those mean the same thing. So we're expressing genes by way of the environment, or maybe it's a little more neutral language to just say we're showing our phenotype. All right. So G by E. Now there are modifications of this that are get interesting. So epistasis, sometimes called G by G by E, is when you have two genes that interact with each other in a way in which if you have one of the genes, then it goes along its merry way expressing itself. But once you have another gene, you get a very different phenotype that comes out. And so this interaction effect may be masked a lot of the times, and then suddenly a particular allele shows up elsewhere, and you suddenly see this pop up. So a kind of classic example of this, often there's nicer sort of mouse examples. I think the textbook will go over kind of a classic mouse one. Here's sort of a simpler case where let's say there is an allele, a gene for, or an allele, a blonde hair allele, a red hair allele. So this is a simple case where it appears like if you have this allele, you will express a phenotype of blonde hair. If you have this allele, you'll express a phenotype for red hair. But if you happen to also have an allele for baldness, then it doesn't matter this, because now this combination of these alleles plus these alleles, this kind of knocks it out there. So what you end up expressing is baldness in both cases. So it's the effect of allele depends upon the presence of other alleles. So there is a genetic background. So that's why this is my structure here. People don't necessarily do this, put the parentheses there. But what I'm implying by the parentheses there is this epistasis sort of creates a genetic component of the environment. So it's like there's a background environment you sit in, but then there's a background genetic environment. So what I'm just trying to get at is that gene expression is very complex. It involves the combinations of not only your genes in the environment, but your genes and other genes. And that can make it very difficult to predict phenotype, which is why we can't just assume there's one allele per trait. That sort of mapping just generally doesn't work. Now there's another epi that, any questions about epistasis here? Again, this is probably review from other courses like 340. Okay. So there's another epi, epigenetics, that we'll talk a lot more about next time. And epigenetics, Again, I'm going to call G by E by E, which some people use. In the social sciences, they often talk about G by E, where the first E might be your the environment during development when you were a child, and the second E is your environment at maturity. And that's a fine way to talk about G by E as well. Here, I'm talking about G by inner environment, and you'll see what I mean by that in a second, and outer environment. So kind of factored out the environment within and the environment without. And so in this case, epigenetics is the study of organismal changes caused by modification of gene expression rather than by alteration of the genetic code itself. There's a lot at the mouthful there. This is a paper that came out this week, actually. And this title, likewise, it might seem like a paradox at first when you read through this title, gene expression variation across genetically identical individuals predicts reproductive tracts, or sorry, traits. So in this particular case, they gave a bunch of C. elegans, a bunch of worms. They studied their reproductive behavior, and they noticed that if you had worms that had identical genes, that some of them consistently would delay laying of their first eggs, and others would lay their first eggs very early. And so, what they were looking for, even though they were reared in similar situations and they had identical genes, they consistently had this different reproductive trait. You might even call it a reproductive behavior, where they would lay eggs at different times. And so what they did is, instead of looking at the genes, which they knew were the same, they looked at so-called gene expression. And we'll talk a lot more about this next time, but they basically looked at the transcripts that were, so, mRNA, for example. So they looked at the messengers that were used in the process of expressing genes, and they found, lo and behold, that if you looked at the if you sampled from the fluid that is floating around inside the worm, you could predict whether it had a late egg laying rate or an early egg laying rate based on what, let's just say, mRNA concentrations that you saw. So that's showing that there is some effect, probably, of the outer environment that creates changes in the inner environment, which changes how genes are turned on and off. And so at this point, they're just saying mechanistically, then if you're trying to figure out what causes the change in egg laying delay, then, well, we know that there are certain genes that are being expressed more in certain individuals and other genes that are being expressed less in other individuals that seem to strongly correlate with this egg laying difference. And so then that allows you to ask questions about what's causing those differences in that expression. So it allows you to push the question. And that's the beauty of Timbergen, is that, as you start answering questions at some levels, then they start then bringing up questions at other levels. Maybe deeper levels, more mechanistic levels, maybe less mechanistic levels. So, deeper hows or expand to whys. And so, but they're at least connecting that there's this observable difference in behavior that is linked not to genes, but to gene expression. And so they can link to which genes are being expressed more. So they know that these worms all have the same alleles, but they can say, even though they have all the same alleles, this particular gene, that particular allele, is getting expressed a lot more often in the worms that lay eggs sooner versus later. And so that's an example of an epigenetic modification where it's not explained by the genes, it's explained by non-genetic factors. And those could be outside of they're generally going to be something that comes into the individual, but they could be something outside of the individual. There are people that take epigenetics and they expand it to the whole ecosystem. They kind of view that as you modify the world around you, then the world around you can modify how you express your genes. And so there are ways in which you can even inherit these modifications. So if you have a house that is enriched relative to the house that you grew up in, your children, even though they borrowed a lot of genes from mom and dad, if they grow up in a different house, then they will have a different future. And some people would actually, say, well, that is, an epigenetic, you could study that from an epigenetic perspective. So those are the two epis, epistasis and epigenetics. We'll talk a lot more about epigenetics next time. But I just wanted to bring that up. Any questions about that? G by E by E. Yeah. So selection, that's so any P, anytime we see P, that is an opportunity for selection to act. So absolutely. So you could say, like, you might find an animal that is really good at doing taxes. And so you set them down to do the taxes, and you find them in the wild, and they're just tax H&R Block machines. And you grab that animal and you say, I'm going to take it into a zoo because I want to study this animal. And you drop them off at the zoo, and suddenly they don't even know how to use a calculator. And you're like, what's wrong here? And it may be that for some reason there was some aspect of the environment that was organized in a way that is what induced the phenotype of being able to do taxes. And so if you happen to be in an environment which gives you that, then that might give you an advantage relative to the other animals around you. And so the genes that allow you to use that aspect of the environment will proliferate. But we wouldn't necessarily say that those are the genes for doing taxes. Those are the genes that, when interacting with this environment, give you the crazy ability to do taxes. Those same genes, when you go over to the zoo, you're in a different environment. And in this case over here, you've lost the ability to do taxes. And so those genes will maybe not proliferate through the artificial population maintained in that zoo. Does that make sense? Yeah. What do you mean by only two? Well, I guess I don't know what an example of it being unlimited be. But the idea here is that there is always, and this is what we're getting into today, there's always some fraction of phenotype that we explain as having a heritable component that usually is a genetic heritable control component, and a non-heritable component, which is that environmental component. And there's some fraction of that. It could be 90-10, it could be 10-90. And what our job is, as and we're working in behavioral genetics, is to figure out that ratio, to figure out what that. So I don't want to call the term genetic basis is kind of loaded. It sounds like that it's 100% genes at the point where you say genetic basis. But in reality, every phenotype that you see is going to have some variation that's going to come from the environment. And so even though you have isogenic individuals, two individuals with the same genes, they're going to have slightly different variations here. Identical twins do not develop into the exact same person. And that is largely, and so we can use identical twins to try to understand how these things split, for example. And we'll talk about that next week in lecture B3, I think. Other questions? Okay, so G by E to P, just that's our mantra, G by E to P, or just G by E. So that's what we'd say now, nature via nurture. Our modern perspective is not, is it G or is it E? And our modern perspective is how much G relative to E explains this. In other words, if we look out at the world and we see variation in phenotype, we see animals that behave in different ways, how much of that behavior comes from changes on the inside, heritable changes that have to do with the genes and the variation in genes across those animals? And how much of that variation has to do with the variation in the environment and the experience accumulated by all of those animals? And that's what we need to figure out, how to build experiments to tease that out. Okay. So, and that gets us to another definition we'll talk a lot more about next time, but so-called heritability. So what is heritability? And so for now, I'm going to say this is sometimes denoted capital H squared or lowercase h squared. So H squared for now is all we'll talk about. Usually people only talk about this lowercase h squared, and I'll talk next time about what's different about these two. But generally speaking, heritability, H squared, regardless, without differentiating big H or little h, is The proportion of phenotypic variation in a population explained by genotypic variation. So, and I want to emphasize, heritability is a measure that does not exist in an individual. It exists in a population. You have to say, how heritable is this trait in this population right here, not in this individual? So you can move from one population to another, and the exact same trait will go from being heritable in one population to not being heritable in another population or being less heritable. So what do we mean by that? We mean that the denominator here is we look across the population and we see how much variation do we see in phenotype. So how many different traits we see? So I see blue eye color, brown eye color, green eye color, and so on. So I see variation in phenotype. So then, if I then sample each individual for their genes, then I can say how different are their genes? And I'm going to see variation in genotype. And so I can use statistical models, linear regressions, to sort of say how much does the variation in genotype predict variation in phenotype? In other words, if your genes are far away from the average, then does that predict that you're accurately predict that your trait is far away from average? And so that allows me to say how much of the rare variation is explained by the genes. So what heritability means basically, so the delta P, that is, we're saying that there's variation in phenotype that is either due to differences in genotype or residual differences, environmental differences, differences that cannot be explained by looking at differences at the genotype level. And heritability is this ratio, is saying if you manage to measure all of the variation in genotype and all of the variation in phenotype, then how is this fraction 1.0, which means the genes predict everything, or is this fraction zero, which would mean that that the genes seem to have no correlation to the phenotype? So even though this person might have a genotype that where all of their alleles are these alleles, another person might have the exact same alleles, but have a totally different phenotype. So that's what we mean by zero heritability. So you look across the population and you compare the variation in genes to the variation in traits. That's where we get heritability, and that's why it only exists at a population level. You cannot say with a single individual, how heritable a particular trait is. You can say this individual in this population, this individual has certain traits. How heritable are these traits in the population that that individual is in? That's the only way we can define heritability. Questions about that so far? This is something we'll drill down into a lot more next time, but just to kind of get us thinking this way. Okay. So, D by E to P, gene expression, phenotypic expression. That's the big thing. What are the relative strengths of genotype and phenotype? Heritability is one way we capture that. If you have a trait that has high heritability, then that means that the gene is driving things in the population. The variation you see in the population is due to the genes. If something has low heritability, then that means the variation you see in the population is just random variation. The consequence of having high heritability means that all your variation is in a component which is passed down from parent to offspring. So if you're in a population where all of the variation you see is highly heritable, then that means that offspring are going to look a lot like parents. But if you're in a population where the variation you see is not very heritable, then offspring are going to be another flip of the coin. And they may have no relationship to parents. Any questions about that? Again, so just sort of basic, review of what you might see in evolution, for example. Okay. All right. So let's do an eye clicker just to if we're all paying attention. I saw a mouse. So I'll do a multiple choice. I'll open it now. All right. So the question is, what term represents the collection of all an individual's traits? Is it heritability, phenotype, genotype or characteristic? And what is the conventional term? You might make some arguments that semantically some of these terms could probably be used that way, but what's the term that we as experts in biology use for the collection of all of an individual's traits? So let's see how people are doing. All right, so we have a large fraction of the class. I'll wait a couple more seconds. All right, so right now I'm seeing almost nobody here. I'm seeing lots of people here. I'm seeing a few people here, and I'm seeing a few more people here. And I was expecting to see the biggest modes at B and at D. And I think both B and D are somewhat acceptable, but B would be the one that I would say is the correct answer. That's the term that you would be expected to use. Characteristic sounds a lot like characters. So characters are like the combination of the ways in which things can vary, not exactly how things are, but the collection of things as they are in an individual we refer to as phenotype, and we should just get used to using that term over and over and over again. Questions about that? All right. So go ahead and stop that one. All right, G by E to P. So let's then drill down into this a little bit more. So when we talk about behavioral genetics, there are these kind of five areas. I'm going to talk a little bit about each one. And then next time, we're going to spend a lot more time in quantitative and biometrical genetics here in particular, and a little bit in molecular. But you know, basically, you know, when we talk about behavioral genetics, it's a very broad field. A lot of people doing a lot of different things. We have to be aware of all of those different things. When you combine the whole community's actions, you get a lot of stuff going on, a lot of activity in this area, a lot of people working in this exciting area. If we zoom in on some of these, then the work in behavioral genetics, you know, goes back pretty far. So we talk about Darwin. You know, Darwin looked out at all these pigeon breeders, and they were artificially selecting pigeons based on their traits. And so you notice a pigeon that has a particular beak. You kind of like that beak shape. You find another pigeon that has a beak shape kind of like it. You breed them together and you get more of that beak shape. And so then you can end up generating this huge diversity in pigeon traits, so pigeon phenotypes that you would never see under natural selection, but under artificial selection, you get them. So it shows that they're possible to observe, and they you know, and they apparently are heritable aspects of the individual, which allows them to be bred, and yet you don't see them in nature. So there must be reasons for that. So it poses a lot of interesting questions. Poses a lot of interesting questions about where that heritable information is stored. It also poses interesting questions about why you don't you know, see all of these variations in nature. So you know, domestication, artificial selection, a lot of interesting classical work in behavioral genetics going back to there. As we get kind of, you know, closer to more modern methods, then we start thinking about phylogenetic explorations. So here I'm showing a cladogram, another representation of phylogenies. Here we're not showing time, we're just showing a relationship among extant species, species that you can, in this case they're swiftlets, and so there's all of these birds. And so these are different birds that you can find today. And there is a molecular phylogeny. So there's ways in which you can say this bird is more closely related to this species is more closely related to this species, and so on. And you get this cladogram. And once you have this cladogram, then you can start using it to answering questions about behaviors and when and how they evolve. So if you look across these swiftlets, these are birds that build a large variety of nests. So this is a behavioral phenotype. So the behavior is how you build the nests. There across these different species, there are consistent ways that they build nests. So that is a, you know, we can put traits, the so-called extended phenotype. We can push traits outside the individual. So if you found multiple hominid species that all had achieved, technological sophistication, their buildings might look different. One species of Homo may have a particular shaped building, another will have another shaped building. They might both be totally functional. And then we would sort of ask, when did these building structures come up? So that's what's going on with these swiftlets, is you notice there's they build them sometimes out of feathers, sometimes out of vegetation, sometimes on the edge of cliffs, sometimes not, sometimes gluing them to cliffs, sometimes not, and so on. And so you can take all of these traits, these nest traits, which are phenotypes, they're extended phenotypes of the swiftlet, and you can map them. So here, what they've done is they said there's different ways to support the nest. There's whether you build it out of vegetation or feathers. There's how close it is to the edge of the cliff. So you look at all these different variations here, and you can color them. So down these things, whether they have one type or the other. And you can, so for each species, you can say their nests tend to look like this, their nests tend to look like this, and so on. And by looking at how the traits cluster and knowing how evolutionarily related the species are, you can start building support for at what point did the traits show up in evolutionary history. So if you notice that, like down here, this group, under support. I think this is like whether they're glued or whether they're supported a different way. And you notice that this bottom group here all use one type of support. This top group use one of them uses this type of support, but the other two use a different type of support. So that sort of gives you the suggestion that, well, maybe that this basal, this is the sort of original trait. So the ancestral swiftlet used this type of support, whatever that is. They glued it to the nest, whatever. But then there was a derived form that broke off. This little subgroup came up with a different type of support to exploit a new niche. So that suggests that maybe this is the older type and this is the newer type. And you could do that same game with all of the other traits here. So that's an example of using molecular information inferred by genetics. So you use the genes of the bird to create these cladograms. And then once you have that genetic information, then you use information about variation and behaviors to then make inferences about when those behaviors might have shown up in evolutionary history. And maybe if you know something about that time, why they showed up at a particular time and not another time. All right, questions about that, this general idea of using genes to develop phylogenies and then using the phylogenies to test evolutionary hypotheses about behaviors. Does that make sense? Okay. So phylogeny, that's one way we can look at things. Another way, quantitative and biometrical genetics. And so quantitative genetics, so we have to talk about quantitative traits. So a quantitative trait is a trait that varies continuously. So oftentimes when we're talking about genetics, like the very beginning of 340 or your high school genetics class, usually we're talking about traits either off or on. You've got your ears are connected or they're not. You've got your there's only six eye colors. We don't think about these variations, but if you think most of the interesting traits, certainly behavioral traits, don't come from a discrete set. Height, for example, it's not like we have three heights. We have a smooth distribution of heights. We have the tones that people make, voices have a huge amount of continuous variation. The way people walk, a bunch of continuous variation. All of these things that don't come from a discrete set, we refer to as quantitative traits, a phenotypic character that has a continuous distribution in trait values across a population, height, weight, et cetera. And quantitative traits created a major challenge for early models of inheritance because the best candidates for inheritance were discrete. They were based on this idea that every gene has a discrete set of alleles. And so then the question is, how do you get continuous variation when th that is heritable? Tall people tend to have tall offspring, but those tall offspring vary a little bit from their parents' height, and they certainly vary across the population. But and so if they are inheriting some aspect of height from their parents, how is that possible if our best candidates for what you inherit are things that are these on-off alleles, dominance and recessive, things like that? And so that was a major challenge. And it ended up getting resolved in the study of, in quantitative genetics, the field of quantitative genetics. And the idea here is that you're going to have, for one, G by E. Some of the variation you get is variation from the environment. So, it might be that your height is determined not only by your genes, but it's determined by, how much you ate, things like that. So those things are going to vary with your life experience, and they're going to vary from things that are outside of the environment. That's one way you get a little bit of variation. The other thing is if you have multiple genes influencing height, you now have multiple ways things can vary. This gene, it might be that there's an allele there. Maybe there's only two alleles in the population, and you can either have one allele or the other. But if you've got 10 genes, each that only have two alleles, then there's 2 to the 10th opportunities for variation. That's 1,024 levels. So now you've got 1,024 levels of at the gene level. And then plus on top of that, you've got the environmental effects, and that sets up a landscape where you can have a lot of continuous variation. And then on top of that, you have these so-called non-additive effects. This is the difference actually between little H and big H heritability. And that's like, if you turn on this gene and this gene, you can have interactions between the genes that go beyond just the addition of the two genes together, these synergistic interactions. And that can also create opportunities for variation. So that was this was sort of the answer to this problem. But and it turns out that most of the traits, certainly in behavior that we look at, are these quantitative traits. So we're not looking for a single gene. We're not looking for the gene for smart or the gene for ribs. We're not looking for those sorts of things. We're looking for the genes and how much they contribute. So you might find that this particular trait that is clearly a trait, like dad's got riz and son's got riz, this is heritable. That it might be that there's 50 genes that are involved in that, and 30 of them are involved in lots of other stuff too. But when you look at those 50 genes, then you can say these couple of genes over here are mostly involved in that, but there's some other support players in here, and there's interactions among those. And that's how we get quantitative traits. So largely what we do in behavioral genetics is not figuring out the gene for a behavior. It's figuring out how across a bunch of genes you get this distribution of influences across behaviors. So any questions about that? Quantitative genetics, which is really the modern way we look at traits. Okay. And then something we talked about last time, evolutionary and population genetics. And so thinking about populations, population structures, things that happen to populations, and how this affects diversity in the traits that we see expressed. So, we said that there are processes that reduce diversity in populations, selection and drift. There are processes that increase diversity in populations, mutation and migration. These are certainly important things that we'll talk about next time as well. And the big thing here is when you think about each one of these, how do these affect heritability? So, if you think about natural selection, for example, if you have a highly heritable trait that provides selective advantage, then those without that trait, those with other traits, will be selected out. So they will not get to pass on their versions of the trait. They will not get to pass on their traits, their versions of the alleles, their versions of the genes. Their alleles get pushed out of the population. And gradually, the population is filled with those that have the good allele, the good trait. At that point, variation loses its heritability. At that point, the gene that has been selected as because it is so much stronger in terms of fitness than the other genes, kind of loses its relative advantage because everybody's got it. And at that point, there is no heritability. So variation that you see doesn't come from variation in that gene because everybody's got the same allele. So heritability gets purged from the population. So generally speaking, as variation declines, as genetic variation declines, then the only thing left to explain variation observed is environmental, which means heritability goes to zero as genetic variation declines. Even if you're breeding, like, imagine you're a breeder and you're breeding dogs or pigeons or whatever, and you really want the pigeon with the biggest beak, and you breed all these pigeons and eventually you just get this giant beak. Eventually that process kind of has to stop, and any variations you see, you're going to try to do those crosses. And the variations you see are just due to the environment. And so those crosses are not going to, you might pick the bigger beak and the other bigger beak and you cross them together, but the offspring has a shorter beak because the variations that you see at that point aren't genetic, they're environmental. So you've now bled all of the heritability out of the population. Everybody's got a big beak, and that's the best you can do. And you just have to stop that. You can't breed for a bigger beak. All right. Any questions about that idea that heritability changes over time with selective pressure? Well, so there are genetic constraints. So we talk about the ability to how to, sometimes it's very hard to get rid of certain traits if they can be masked genetically. And so it may not be possible to get rid of something, but if there's something that is a strong selective disadvantage or a strong selective advantage, then initially that new process of selection, because it's artificial, a breeder comes in and they start breeding for this thing that nature didn't care about. At that point, they're going to start with a background heritability. And that will allow them, at least at first, to get rid of some of the bad traits or promote some of the good traits. But that they will eventually lose their efficacy at that, because as they go on over time, then they just lose control, like they lose control authority over it. And so they're left with whatever the background genetic architecture gives them. Any other questions about that? Something we'll also talk about more a little next time. That gives an opportunity to talk about, to introduce another term that's important, hopefully a term you've seen before as well. Another class is ecotype. So if we think about these two pressures up here, both of these can be related to spatial isolation. So I can take a population of alligators or something, and I can separate them so that they stop breeding together. And now I have two separate populations. Now it happens to be that this population over here has a lot more sunlight than this population over here. And so over time, after they've been separated, I start noticing that these alligators get one trait, they become really aggressive, and these alligators get another trait, they're really passive. And so the question is, what do I attribute the difference in their behavior to the environment? Or to the fact that I separated them and drift. So basically, is it selection or drift? So in this area here that has more sunlight, it might be that sunlight happens to select for more aggressive alligators. And over here, lack of sunlight, you end up getting maybe the aggressive alligators have a cost with no sun. There's no reason to pay that cost. And so you end up getting more of that passive alligator. Or it could be genetic drift. Like it might be that I've made the population smaller and I just happen to randomly just put more aggressive alligators in this population and more passive alligators in this population. And due to random bad luck events that occur in both populations, the one with the numbers advantage happens to be the one that fills the population. So that point has nothing to do with sunlight. It has to do with the fact that I split them into two small populations. And so the question is, selection versus drift, which one was it? Is there a selective advantage of aggression, or is it just random by chance? And if it's a selective, there's selective advantage, then we refer to that trait or that morph, I guess, of that species as an ecotype. So an ecotype is a variation that you see in species that has been selected for due to a difference in environment. And so, there might be honeybees. There's European honeybees. Sean works with European honeybees, and there are a bunch of subspecies. There's what the Italians, the what are some of the others? Oh, that's fine. I didn't prep, but he knows them. And you can breed all of them together. But they've been separated. And so they come into the lab with different sets of traits. And so we refer to them as ecotypes because, well, we think we have good evidence that those traits were selected for by their local environments, not necessarily just because they're separated. So that's what we mean by ecotype, is that it's a genetically and usually geographically differentiated population within a species that is environmentally selected, slightly stronger than a morph. This is a product of selection. It's not genetic drift. So it's not the result of founder effects. It's not the result of genetic bottlenecks. If those are what's going on, then we wouldn't refer to it as an ecotype. Question.
Could still say
What really depends on, so there's the general idea that you separate populations and you get different traits that come out, but it's really the question of what ecotype is you're actually making a stronger claim where you're saying the reason we're seeing the difference in traits is that these traits give them an advantage in their environment. It could be the differences in traits are completely random, as you see in founder effects or genetic bottlenecks. So in evolution, you might talk about founder effects or genetic bottlenecks. Those are special cases of drift. Those are cases where you've now got a small population, and that population just happens to randomly have a certain set of individuals in it. And those with a numbers advantage are going to end up dominating that population. And that has nothing to do with the advantage of having those traits. It's just purely random. It's bad luck or good luck, however you want to phrase it. That is what the founder effect or genetic bottlenecks or drift does. That's different than ecotypes. Ecotypes, the claim is that that individual, that it's there's a repeatable way that if you took other individuals and moved them into that area, they would also evolve the same traits because those traits provide a fitness advantage in that environment. That's an ecotype. So you can still breed, but this subpopulation is selected for this local environment. This subpopulation is selected for this local environment. So Africanized honeybees, that's an example of a, those are, there was an African ecotype that was very aggressive. It could breed with the European type, and it created very aggressive European honeybees. And so you can have Africanized honeybees that have gone through a breeding process, and then they may not need that aggression the same way that the African honey ecotype, it was selected for. But now they express that trait. And it makes it so that like beekeeping in the South is very different than beekeeping in the North. In the North, you happen to see a new fertilized queen and you're like, oh, that's great. That saves me a lot of money. In the South, you're like, kill it. Because if that is an Africanized queen, then that could produce an Africanized that actually could start Africanizing even the existing population, but that could create a very aggressive and dangerous situation if you're trying to raise European honeybees, as an example. So these are heritable variations that provide function from their local environment. Was there another question? Okay, that's what I mean by ecotypes. The clear meaning by ecotype is about selection. It's very different than drift. Okay. So then, when we speak about selection, I just want to then give a couple of interesting examples of weird ways that you wouldn't, when you think about things that would be selected for, you wouldn't necessarily predict these. And so I've got a group of things here where these are three phenomena that have to do with predictions from selection that actually predict why you might keep a costly trait despite the fact that it's costly. So you see a costly trait that's out there, you're like, wow, that's costly. What's going on there? You can say, well, maybe just bad luck genetic drift. The costly trait happened to just have an advantage, and you haven't had an infusion of the better traits, and so you're stuck with the costly one or whatever. Here we're talking about that it's actually selection would select for and maintain costly traits. Those are these three. And then down here, you actually say normally you would expect selection to find a trait that is really strong and everybody would converge on that. There would be pressure for everyone to express that strong trait. But down here, we're talking about that selection actually creates the maintenance of two extremely different traits that have that are used for the similar thing. Question. Yeah, so that's a great and very detailed question, and that certainly relates. This is going to be related to this correlated characteristic, but these four are examples here. But there are plenty of other examples that have to do with linkage among in the genetic architecture that make it very difficult to get rid of one thing without getting rid of another thing. And so there are different mechanisms that that happens, and that's one particular one. And this is just, this correlated characteristic, which we'll start with, will give an idea of how that could happen. But then you can imagine other mechanisms that act in a very similar way, like the one that you just mentioned. So it's a great question, but and I'm not saying this is an exhaustive list, but I'm saying selection doesn't always do the kind of easy thing. Let's take a quick look at that. So a correlated characteristic. This is this kind of swallowtail here. So this is an example where you have a developmental constraint that causes a trait to be expressed in both sexes. The benefits of the trait in one sex outweigh the costs of the trait in the other sex. And so these are these deleterious effects. And so in this particular case here, females prefer males with long tails for reasons that might actually relate to the handicap principle that we'll get to later. That leads to females with longer tails. So there's a developmental constraint that says that if you're an offspring, if your dad has a long tail, even if you're a female offspring, you get stuck with a long tail. Females aren't being selected for their long tails, the males are being selected for long tails, but your dad had a long tail, so you have a long tail. And in fact, that long tail is very costly. So females with longer tails have less offspring in the long run. But the benefits to males is much stronger than the cost to females. So in order for a female to cope with this developmental constraint, she has to compensate through other traits. And so that might mean, say, for example, putting more parental investment into offspring. So she can't have as many offspring in the long run. So she'll make sure that the offspring she has survive much greater than they would if she had a shorter tail. So this is an example of a correlated characteristic. Other examples are nipples on male mammals, for example. Can't get rid of them. It would be too much of a developmental change. It'd be too costly. And so the male expresses them at cost to the male for generating this biomass that it doesn't need. And so then you end up getting these things which only have function in the female. Horns, antlers, and ungulates are used for male-male competition. And so those are things that you can see expressed on a male that end up showing up on the female as well, even though they aren't, don't go into. Don't play any role that we can see in female-related social behavior. And then mate choice, like I said here, these barn swallow examples here. And you can read more about this barn swallow example where they actually experimentally elongated tail feathers of females at the beginning of breeding seasons and studied what that did to the production of offspring. And they could show that by artificially making their tails longer or shorter, then you could basically program how many offspring the female is going to have. But then what you also saw is that the females with the long tails ended up, for every offspring they had, they put more investment into the offspring, and every offspring was more likely to survive. So females that get stuck with long tails end up borrowing from their energy reserves and so on to end up putting more effort into their offspring because it's almost like they know that they're not going to be able to produce as many offspring. Now, I don't want to confound proximate and ultimate. I'm not saying they actually know that, but there is some mechanism inside them that when they have a long tail, it causes them to divert more resources to each individual offspring. And that tends to actually counterbalance this issue, this developmental constraint. That's what we mean by correlated characteristics. Any questions about that? An advantage in one sex ends up causing a disadvantage to show up in another sex because of developmental constraints. Okay, so that's a correlated characteristic. There's also phylogenetic inertia. This one's shorter. Common example of that, this is my dog Dexter again. This was Dexter when he was a puppy. This is Dexter a little older. He really likes to spin in place. Wolves like to spin in place. This is this spinning in place before laying down. It is very temporally costly. He can spin in place for like a minute before he lays down in pretty much the same spot that he started in. Now, the leading hypothesis for why dogs spin in circles before laying down is that in an evolutionary history, there were wolves that actually, where you laid down, you had to be very careful. You didn't lay down on something that could sting you or bite you or those sorts of things. And so this process of spinning in place would clear things out, would allow for surveying and so on. And just spinning in place would do that without a whole lot of cognition going on there. Just if you spun in place for long enough, you could create a safe spot to lay down. And so the thought is that dogs now continue to do that, even though they need to, even though they aren't, it's not like they're actively looking for a safe space to lay down. It's just hanging around. It is not that costly. I mean, for one, these are artificially selected, and so there's not really a mechanism for it to, nobody's selecting, no one's saying, wow, this dog spins too much, I'm not going to breed them. You could, but no one's doing that. But even in the wild, and if there wasn't a need for this, it just doesn't generate that many fitness disadvantages to having it, so it just hangs out. It's actually would be harder to get rid of it than it would be to keep it, so it just keeps on keeping on. That's what we mean by phylogenetic inertia. It had a benefit at one time. That's how it got selected for. But now the benefit has kind of faded away, but it'd be too costly to get rid of it. So you're stuck with it. Any questions about that? All right. The other interesting case here, which we've seen one example of, is the handicap principle. So this is a case like sodding, which we saw in the first lecture. Very costly behavior. This animal could run away at a much higher speed. Instead of diverting its energy into darting away, it slows down some to leap up into the air and take this shape. And it still manages to get away. But what's interesting is that it is a very conspicuous signal, and we'll learn about what signals are versus cues later on in the semester, but it's a very conspicuous signal to predators that it is so healthy, so fast that it can do this little skipping and hopping around and still manage to survive. And so when a predator sees this, predators that ignore this and still go after these prey end up not getting any meal. Predators that learn that they should run away from this, because it actually is an honest signal that this is fast, then they end up, because it's a handicap. Like, this is a handicap. If this adult animal, the adult prey animal, is still alive and this is how it runs, there's no way you're catching up to that. It is an honest signal. So, this is saying, so predators that have evolved to cue off of this or signal off of this, accept this signal and go after other prey that don't do this are more successful predators. So that just enforces this costly signal. So it turns out a lot of signals, in order for them to have meaning, have to be costly. So you wouldn't think that you would maintain these weird behaviors, but when you're in the background of social behavior, when you're in the background of observers, of information flows, and so on, then sometimes you get costly behaviors that are have informational value, even though their physiological value seems nil. So that's what we mean by the handicap principle. Lots of examples of the handicap principle, not just sodding, more popular example, this male peacock. There's a peahen here, it's displaying to the peahen. The idea here is that the peahen is going to perhaps prefer males that can display these costly signals because it is actually signaling something about the male. If the male can survive with this rattling, with this highly conspicuous tail, that also creates a major cost when flying itself. If this thing hangs around despite having this cost, it must have a lot of other good stuff going for it. And that is an example of a handicap. And so the handicap is selected for. And this idea of the handicap principle, most people credit to this behavioral ecologist named Zahavi. So it's a name you see a lot when you're talking about handicaps. So any questions about the handicap principle? We'll actually talk more about the handicap principle when we get to signaling later in the semester as well. But another example where you wouldn't expect selection, like this seems very puzzling, the nature would drive this trait. But it turns out that maybe actually it's predictable. Okay. The last one I want to highlight here is disruptive or diversifying selection. So, this idea that you would normally expect to see a single trait, but instead you see two very different traits. And there's a bunch of examples of this. This is one in cuttlefish. So, it turns out that there's multiple reproductive strategies in male cuttlefish, these cephalopods. So it turns out that some cuttlefish will act like a female, so they will display female traits, and males, bigger cuttlefish males, very masculine cuttlefish males, will ignore these more female-like males. They'll be able to go around the competitive males, hang out with the females, and then while and then after the competitive males are away, then they get their shot at the females. And so we have these two very different, very masculine cuttlefish and very feminine male cuttlefish, and they coexist in the population. In fact, they almost create opportunities for each other. And that's what we mean is disruptive selection or diversifying selection. These two morphs end up creating opportunities which actually which maintain both in the population. This is also why we think we have egg and sperm or male and female in sexually reproducing animals, is that that's another example of diversifying selection. You wouldn't expect selection to select for two competing traits that are at opposite extremes, but it turns out that when they are at opposite extremes, they create opportunities for each other, which end up actually maintaining both in the population. All right. So, any questions about? So, here's pictures of those cuttlefish, and you can read the captions to see who's who there offline. So, any questions about these four examples of kind of counterintuitive ways that selection can maintain costly things in the environment? All right. So, and then the last one, which we'll talk more about next time, is molecular genetics. So, this is a more modern way to talk about behavioral ecology. So, the next two lectures, it's all about separating, and there's one more clicker question. It's all about separating environment from genotype, G by E, these two things together. So, the next one, we're talking about how to experimentally discriminate between genetic and environment. And then how to quantify the relationship between genotype and complex variable phenotype. It's all about G by E. So flipping back to our dog example here, so nature via nurture, we got the genes, that's the dog. The big, the G genes is the dog, the blue genes is the J genes. That's the genes here. You might look at this dog and say, hey, that dog's kind of cute. You look at this dog and say, hey, that's kind of ugly. If we look, if we say, well, the only difference between those dogs are the genes, J genes that they're wearing, then that's an environment that is explaining that phenotype. But I'm hoping this captures that the cuteness or ugliness of this dog is a combination of the underlying dog and the things you put on the dog, the G by E. So that's kind of our message. So that's what we talk about. That is our core question of this unit. Is it G? Is it E? Or if it's both, what's the combination of G and E together? All right, that's what we went over through today. That's your reminders of the assignments here. Let's do one of these. And if there's any other questions, happy to take them. And the TAs would also be happy to take them up here. So the question, start a new multiple choice. All right, so what is a likely explanation for the maintenance of costly tail feathers traits in female barn swallows? Is it correlated characteristics, phylogenetic inertia, disruptive selection, or the handicap principle? So go ahead and answer that. That's all I got for you today. Any other questions, feel free to come up. PAs would love to talk to you. And then also, as I pack up, I'm happy to help as well.